Welcome back, everybody. It's the TV Talk Machine. Remember us? We're back. This is episode 246. I'm Jason Snell. And across the internet from me is a guy who, you know, he left his old career behind, got some new tattoos, and is feeling good. It's Tim Goodman. Hello.
Yes, that's very good of you to pull that out. I think I opened some eyes the other day at yoga because people were like, is that a poem?
You have Elvis Costello lyrics on your legs.
I do. And they're like, what's the name of that song? And I said, When I Was Cruel. And you get that kind of like side look like, oh, that's an interesting dark choice there. But then I explained to them that it's me sort of memorializing the past of my life as a critic. I spent so much of my life as a critic in many phases.
Yeah.
And this is kind of just putting that part of my life behind me and acknowledging that it did cause some problems with me, but it was also a nice career, and but now I'm moving past that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say this podcast, it, like you, is, you know, it was it did its time doing one thing, and now it's more relaxed, and it's doing something new.
Yeah, it's all tatted up.
And we've got some. Yeah, it is. That's exactly it. I'm going to update the show art to have the bastard machine tatted up. The gotten some interesting feedback. So some people are like, but no, what about shows? Jason, can you find another TV critic to do a podcast with? And then there are also people who are like, look, I'm just there to hear, you know, you guys talk, and that's fine. And it's, the truth is, you know, we can't, neither of us are TV critics now. So we can't do that. I'm not going to tell you about the newest premieres, although I did watch a couple of shows, and I'll report in about those.
I'll hear that. Yeah. I think it's still handy to, like, every now and then say, hey, I watched this thing, and it actually turned out pretty good.
It's just that, you know, you're not... honestly, Tim, I looked at that picture of you getting the tattoo, and I thought, it's got to feel so freeing, and knowing the lyrics to that song, I had this moment of picturing you watching, slogging through a show at 2 a.m. and thought, you know, because as a kid, I was like, oh, TV critic, that sounds like a really good job. And knowing you and picturing that, I'm like, oh, get me out of there. Right. Like I just, so you're a free man is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
it's good.
Definitely. And it feels, it feels healthier.
It's time to do something else.
Yeah. I feel like, I'm happy not to be on that treadmill. I'm also happy not to be sort of churning through the emotional aspects of what that job does to you. But and now working on things that are more creative.
Well,
so it's happy.
Judging other people's work, although, I mean, again, I feel like you ended up doing two things that you gravitated toward for reasons, one of which was the understanding about how the industry is changing.
Right.
Which is different. And also, I know you took delight in curating stuff where you're like, here's stuff you should watch that's exciting and fun. And then the more, you know, whenever you're throwing somebody under the bus, whenever you're kicking somebody's project and saying this is no good. I mean, it can be fun, but it is also pretty corrosive.
Yeah, it's corrosive. And the thing that I think we struggle with, anybody who's ever been a critic and, that includes, you know, you do a lot of product stuff as well. And you talk critically about things on podcasts. It's the thing that I just try to remember people to tell people is like, you know, I'm not like, it's not like somebody put their third grader's artwork up on the internet and I'm trashing it. Right. Like there's a level of cruelty there that is, super corrosive. But in my world, it's like, it's the marketplace of ideas. These people are in a for-profit business. And they are putting their stuff out there. They want a large audience. They want acceptance. There's lots of money tied to it. So they're fair game.
And yeah, it's true. So, it's just it becomes. I had a back and forth with a couple of people last week about a dumb, you know, computer related story. But it was one of those things where sometimes you have to be honest, and that means you have to be brutally honest about things that bother you. Like, I mean, you always have to be honest, but sometimes you have that moment where you're like, do I let this go by or do I stop and say, no, right. This is no good. And I did that happened to me. I'm being very oblique here, but that happened to me a couple weeks ago. And it's like, I got a lot of people mad at me. And it's like, it's not fun, but I stand by my opinion, and I don't regret, you know, taking a swing and not letting that ball go by me because I think it was the right thing to do. But at the same time, you know, that was one incident, and that has stayed with me for 2 weeks now, basically.
Yeah. It's really hard. It would have been harder had I lived down there.
Oh God!
You're running into all these people, I'm sure.
No, I hide in my garage. It's
okay,
fine.
Good. Yeah,
they have no idea they can't find me.
I think the thing that I struggled with, and at the end I found, as you noted, I found other ways around it. I much prefer to do something positive and turn people onto like great shows. So that was the best part of the job, and you know, and so that's why I stopped writing at all about network dramas, because they just were never going to meet the level of acceptance that I was. It was just like, it's bad for me and it's bad for the people who made those shows for me to critique them. But it was so much more fun to talk about things that were good. On the other hand, I also had no problem criticizing shows where I thought, man, it's 2019. Like, this is the best time in the world to be hardest, but also the best time to making a television show. And you throw this half-baked idea into the, you know, into the arena. And I thought you can get criticized. I had no problem criticizing that, because it was like, God, look at all this great stuff. And then I'm like, oh, maybe your terrible project that you just threw into the arena, maybe you blocked somebody else more creative from getting their chance because you've had shows in the past. And, you know, and I think that those shows are open for more criticism. But yes, I much prefer to turn people on and to new shows, or I did, and say, hey, here's a curated list of 33 things from last year.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the treadmill, you know, you just sort of have to watch all that stuff, and you can't just discard the stuff that, I mean, I do that a lot now with what I do is I only write about things that excite me for the most part. Like, if it's bad, I just don't write about it. It's just, forget it. I'm not going to, like, why would I go through that? So, resoundingbastard.com. Is where people can go. This is you talked about it last time. By the way, we're recording this on a Wednesday for people who keep track of this, because we missed Thursday because I was traveling, so we moved it to Friday, and then it became Wednesday, so it's almost Thursday again. So we've wrapped all the way around. In Australia, it is Thursday. That's how bananas this is. But 2 weeks ago, we talked about this, 2+ weeks ago, that you were launching this site. It's up now. You know, you've got a Squarespace site where you've got you're writing about music. Mm-hmm. And anything you want to say about, like, the idea? I mean, there's a post. People can go read, "So what is this?" And they will get what this is.
Yeah, and actually the response has been really, really good. Actually, probably better than I thought it was going to be, as far as, like, the analytics on that site. Especially for something I kind of pimped it for the first week, and then I kind of haven't. I just, you know, added a new thing. I'll be adding probably, you know, like, in a 2 week span, I could do between 1 and 2 pieces for it. I was just happy to get it up and launched, and it's a great side project for me. And you know, at the same time, it actually is going to turn into something that will be in book form at some point, which is nice to know. I would say that I probably haven't actually written or more than one of the ones that I would even consider that, and the longer pieces are coming down the road. But yeah, for me, the most important thing is that it's up and it's launched. I do laugh when some people still think that that is actually my new job.
Interesting.
I'm like, okay, well, yeah, if you think I could actually make money and to live in the Bay Area and put people through college on a basically really small
little Squarespace blog.
Yeah, Squarespace blog about music that I love. That's awesome. I think that's if people think that that's how I'm making my money, that's cool.
It's not how it works. I wanted to talk about, so you did two pieces. You did a piece about liking women singers.
Yeah.
And you did your Allo Darlin' Unexpected playlist. Mm-hmm. And yes, we're going to talk about music right now, folks.
Yeah,
so watch out. Hang on. I really enjoyed both of these pieces, and it got me thinking, because I remember I had a moment of realization. I don't know whether it was in high school or college, but I had this moment of realization where I was looking at my CDs. So probably college, like all my CDs back when we had like a rack with CDs in it.
Oh, yeah. Love those days.
And I realized that I don't think I owned more than a handful of CDs that were with women singers. Mm-hmm. Almost everything I had was by men. It was almost entirely white men, and it was it was in fact almost entirely white men from either the UK or from the Commonwealth.
Right. Yes.
Right. It wasn't even there were some Americans in there, but it was mostly white guys from England, and you know, maybe, you know, you throw in Crowded House, you got Australia and New Zealand in there, but
sure.
Like, and you two from Ireland,
Scotland.
But again,
uh-huh.
But you're talking about British Isles. So UK, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, like, and the U.S., and mostly men. And the men part, it struck me because today I would say more than half of the tracks on the playlist that I make for myself are by women. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know. I'm sure I've been aided by the fact that the curation that I'm listening to on streaming services, that they are thinking more broadly than I was at the time. And then I get exposed to this stuff and I love it. But, you know, over the course of 20 years, I have really, I think, changed my perspective, or the perspective that I've desired to get out of music has changed. And the balance is completely shifted in what I listen to.
Yeah, same as I said in that piece. And isn't it kind of funny how you kind of realize it? Like, I felt like I could have written, I mean, like 20,000 words on all the female singers that I listened to, but I realized that, like, there's probably a much longer essay for this eventual book in there somewhere. But I thought that it would be fun to sort of track, like, where did you start? Like, what was the one where and you read it, so you know, like, my breakdown was, okay, yeah, you listened to, you heard female singers on the radio and you might have liked one of their songs. But when was the one where you thought, oh my God, that, whoever that is and whatever that band is with this female singer, I need that whole album. Mm-hmm. And that to me was a game changer. It was fun to actually go back and track that and then leave everything at the bottom. Like, yeah, okay, in the modern day, I've got 10,000 female singers. But as you said, I really think that that's an honest assessment of, you know, your past, where you were looking at what it was like in those CD days and post-college days of like, I wasn't really even paying attention. But now that I actually, you know, whatever part of your brain said, hey, this is a little lopsided. You went and fixed it in some way, or it just magically changed itself over time. And I think that's what that post is trying to get at.
Yeah. And I mean, some of it, not all bands with women singers are there are often men songwriters involved, but I think just right. Once a woman is singing the song, it's unlikely that they're going to, I mean, I suppose the dynamics can be varied, but like you're putting words in her mouth. I think that she's participating. The perspective is going to be different. It's going to be different,
in
some way or other. And yeah, my little tiny breakthrough in college was, in high school, was Eurythmics, where it was, you know, where Annie Lennox was like, right.
Yes.
Like that,
uh-huh.
that was a little crack, but I was thinking in the early 2000s for me, the big breakthrough was Imogen Heap. And her Frou Frou album with Guy Sigsworth, but then she went out and did a couple of solo albums. And there was a period in the sort of early to mid 2000s where I was basically just listening to her albums on repeat. That was it. And that was kind of the breakthrough for me. That not only did I really like that kind of electro pop kind of music, but her voice and the way she used it. Those were albums written and produced and performed entirely by her, basically. And I still love those albums today.
Yeah, I think that the two that I mentioned there with the Camera Obscura, for starters, was my, you know, Tracy Ann Campbell's my favorite singer. But when you get into Jenny Lewis and Rilo Kiley, the connections are that they both have really great voices and they both write their own songs and they write them in different ways. It was the same thing. It's like having a breakthrough and seeing that. I had already kind of been established when I fell in love with both of those people for their songwriting skills and their singing skills, especially. And it's also just like you've discovered somebody. I mean, because Imogen Heap is like, she's really eclectic. That's a very eclectic choice. And it's almost in some ways that like Nico Case, which is, I'm a big fan of hers, very, very eclectic in the same way.
Yeah. I have a couple other points. One is, people should listen. Read Tim's piece about Allo Darlin and the playlist, because that is some really great pop music. It's really enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
You mention it in the story, but I'm going to mention it here. It's a slight spoiler for the song "Kiss Your Lips" by Allo Darlin. But there is a moment a minute into that song, and you know, and I hadn't really thought about it until I listened to this song. But I always love it when songs quote other songs, like or reference other songs.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you know, some people do it to themselves. Like Sting loves referencing his own songs.
Yeah.
Come on, Sting. But I love it. Like Fountains of Wayne has a song where they talk about singing. In the song, the character is singing Just the Way You Are, the Billy Joel song.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And there's a very quick Don't Go Changing.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I'm like, oh, that is so good. So then I get to this song. And a minute in, she's talking about how her boyfriend or whatever has a favorite Weezer song. And we all sang it on the Ferris wheel or something.
Mm-hmm, right.
And immediately the song... with multiple voices, not just her voice, the song sings the chorus for El Scorcho by
yeah.
Weezer,
uh-huh.
And then goes back and then kicks back into the song. It's just, I don't know, it's a magical moment, and I love it when music does that. It like sends shivers down my spine when I heard that, because it's like, well, wait a second.
Yeah.
You're now actually going to sing that song now. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's beautifully done. It's also that song never sort of flags. It's always so upbeat.
Yeah.
And that Weezer song choice is so, it's also super upbeat. So it's like a great mesh of that. I don't know. I figure like not a lot of people had heard of Alan Darling
no.
at all. Like, no, I mean, my whole point of that thing was like, no one has ever said, you know, I mean, outside of you, like that they've known Alan Darling. And I put some songs on there that you can click. Obviously, that's the benefit of having the site. We talk right. about music. It's like Jason and I, if we were talking about it right now and we were overlaying these comments with the actual song, that's kind of what, you know, Resounding Bastard does, is it, you know, the resounding
yeah.
site.
And you can
is,
get the playlist, the Spotify yeah. or Apple Music playlist, which I immediately did. I just popped
yeah,
it in there.
And it just like jumped down there. And I just love that you can play it, because it's like the songs yeah. are so catchy. Every time you click one, I kept thinking, I could be wrong, but I kept thinking like, who doesn't love these songs? Like all these songs are so great. I don't know. That's what I yeah. love about doing this music thing.
That's great. And I made a little list. I looked at my recent playlist and I made a little list of all the women or women led bands that I've liked over the last couple of years. I'm going to just throw them out here for
Let's
people
hear it.
Who are curious.
I want to hear it. Yes.
Churches.
Oh yes. Uh-huh.
I love
you say that.
Mm-hmm. Electro pop stuff. Churches is great. Maggie Rogers. If you haven't heard her,
I don't know Maggie Rogers.
Really, she's got her album is really good. You should check it out.
Okay, all right.
I really like Halsey, which is funny because my daughter is very amused that I like Halsey, because that's something that a younger person should like. But I really like Halsey.
Yes.
There's another electro dance pop band called Chairlift. The lead singer's name is Caroline Polachek. She has a solo album now. Really love her stuff. And then there's a bunch of others. Chairlift is super very Imogen Heap, actually. Both of them, she sounds a lot like Imogen Heap. Caroline Polachek. And then there are a bunch of others, like Claro is pretty good. Florence and the Machine.
Oh yeah,
great.
Yeah, excellent.
I like there are two bands, four letter all capitals. It's weird. Heim and Eider are both good, different female led bands.
Yes, I don't know Eider. I know Heim. But
yeah, no. Eider nobody knows, but I found her on Apple Music and it's pretty good. Kay Flay is great. I really enjoy her. My daughter hates Kay Flay, but I think she's great.
I love it.
Pale Waves is essentially the female version of the 1975. If you like the 1975,
oh, what a great way to put that together.
It is. Well, I mean, their album is produced by the 1975, it's like it's weird. It's basically that. And so anyway, lots of women led stuff in my playlist these days. But
Churches
is probably my favorite. Either Churches or the 1975, my favorite discoveries of the last decade. So yeah.
Wow. Okay. Love that. So that you should attach that to our little thing.
I will. I'll throw it in there.
Yeah.
Attach that to the little thing. That's uh-huh. that's what we call it. I have some TV to talk about.
Okay.
Remember television, Tim?
Yeah, I do. Yes, vaguely.
Uh-huh. Here on the music machine.
The music tattoo.
Yeah, music
yoga
tattoo
machine.
Yeah. Tim's a very tattooed man. That's what it'll be called. Tim is a very tattooed man. TVTM. Okay, follow up from last time. Listener Jamie challenged us to watch Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, the NBC show. It's an hour long show, so I guess it's like a dramedy kind of thing. mostly for San Francisco reasons, because it's set in San Francisco. And I just want to confirm to listener Jamie and listener Jamie's, I think maybe girlfriend who was watching with him. The place she lives all by herself would cost a fortune, and they would really, her startup would really need to be paying her an enormous amount of money for her to be able to afford that place. I'm just saying. It's true. They do make good use of San Francisco. I have to admit that at least in the pilot, I mean, they're probably not ever going to come back and shoot more in there. I watched part of the second episode, and this is my review of Zoe's extraordinary playlist. I couldn't take it. Like, I watched the pilot, and then I saw that there were more episodes available before we recorded this, and I was like, oh, okay. And I started watching episode 2, and I got like 5 minutes in, like, I just can't.
Yeah, but that's life's too short.
What sometimes. I will say is, it is in the genre of network TV musical. So if the fact that there's a musical was enough to make you interested in something like Glee or something like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I'd say Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist doesn't have the smarts and the sharpness of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, but it does have song and dance numbers with interesting characters. It's very broad. It doesn't really work for me. But there it is. But the San Francisco stuff, it's nice to see it. And yes, it's totally unrealistic. It would cost a fortune. There's no way any of those people. Also, I will say Lauren Graham is in it, and I love Lauren Graham. But there are several moments in the musical numbers where where Lauren Graham is in the background, and I keep thinking that they're trying to hide her. Why did she agree to be on this show where there are musical numbers? She seems embarrassed by the whole thing. And there are a couple moments where she's visible in the background, and then you cut to a different shot and she's just disappeared because she's like, yeah, I'm not going to be in this anymore.
I'm not going to do that. Yeah. My God, that's very funny.
So I kind of feel bad for her.
She's like, you know, I did a superior version of this on Gilmore Girls, and we just had the guy walking around.
The troubadour.
Yes.
Yeah, who was the troubadour? I've seen him in concert.
The troubadour is oh my God, it's just like, well, I love him. Because he has two bands. Buffalo Toms, or no, Buffalo Grant Lee Phillips.
Grant Lee Buffalo, yes, Grant Lee Phillips. I saw him open at the Fillmore for Crowded House, probably, or Neil Finn.
Oh yeah, Grant Lee Phillips, who was in a band called Grant Lee Buffalo to start. Is great. He is a wonderful singer. I think actually Spin Magazine at one point said he was the best American male singer, which is really obscure because he's so obscure. But his voice is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he was the
wandering troubadour of Stars Hollow on Gilmore Girls.
And if you watch that, somebody put together like a supercut. It's really bad because it's like bad low quality. But he covers a lot of great songs, and he did. You know, say what you want about that show. I loved it, but they really know their music.
Yeah. Speaking of music, I watched episode 1 of High Fidelity on Hulu.
Yeah. Okay.
So just as the background, I read the book when it came out.
I did too. Loved it.
You know, it is a book that is both about music and liking pop culture things, mm-hmm. and also about being being a man with misplaced priorities and understanding of the importance of various things in one's life. And I think people might miss that, but that's really what it's about.
Yeah.
Loved it. Happy when the movie came out. Enjoy the movie a lot. I've seen it a bunch of times. It's we're coming up to the 20th anniversary of that movie now.
Yeah.
And how you can really tell it's been a while is that Hulu is now making a High Fidelity TV show that owes a lot to the movie and of course to the book, but also to the movie, I think. And there are definitely references to the movie in the show, retelling this story again. But the thing that blows me away is that the lead is Zoe Kravitz, who is the daughter of Lisa Bonet and Lenny Kravitz. And of course, Lisa Bonet was in the movie High Fidelity. So that's weird.
It is. Yeah. It's like, I can feel the bones getting more creaky.
Yeah. And she's great. She's great. Mm-hmm. She's Rob. So they did a gender swap on the character. She's bisexual. So she's got exes who are men and exes who are women. Mm-hmm. You can see how if you're familiar at all with the story, you can sort of see how it's going. But I gotta say, you know, we've people who've been watching TV for a long time have always been talking about how TV is a better medium for a novel because you can't in 2 hours and an hour and a half, even 2.5 hours in a movie theater, like that's a short story.
Yeah.
That there's not room to adapt a novel into that. You lose so much. And you see it in High Fidelity, where episode one contains mostly stuff you saw in the movie, even. Certainly all the stuff in the book. But it's like episode one of a whole season. Right. And it isn't slow. It's just taking the appropriate amount of time to meet the characters and learn about Rob and her whole background. And I think it was really well done. I think the music selections are good. Obviously, you're going to be under huge scrutiny if you do High Fidelity to make good music selections. But I think that the in-character discussion of music is appropriately modern, and the music selections are good, with, you know, also a nod to the classics so that it doesn't feel like I think they wanted to cast a broad net when they talk about music. So there's older stuff and newer stuff, and, you know, they don't play Katrina and the Waves when they turn on the music on Monday morning in this version, but they do play something that is a decent analog for that. So yeah, nice. I like that.
Okay. All right. I am actually going, that's on my list of things to watch specifically because I loved the book and the movie and I like music. So
yeah, great. And I watched a couple episodes of Avenue 5 on HBO, and I'll just say, it's okay.
I don't even know what that is.
That's Armando Iannucci's comedy about spaceship cruise liner.
Man, that tells you a lot because I saw the promos and I was like, what the hell? And then I was like, and I love Armando Iannucci, so it just tells you how far I'm out of this world.
Well, I will tell you, you know, it's fine. It's not very funny. I think that's the problem. I think it's okay. Yeah. You've got to really enjoy watching awful people, which is, I think the challenge is awful people in a comedy is passable, but when it's just awful people and the jokes aren't landing as much, it's harder. And I feel like with a couple episodes at least into that, I struggle to go back to it because Hugh Laurie's great. There's a lot of good premise stuff, but also most of the characters are terrible. So,
okay. All right. All right. Maybe save me some time there. Okay.
That's my quick review of that. So, we should talk about the homework. We gave everybody homework last time.
Yes. Including you.
Including me. I mean, I'd already seen it, but I watched again. Mm-hmm. Episodes 1 through 4 of season 1 of Netflix's Sex Education. This is something that you said last time is interesting to watch and think about how it manipulates your learned television biases because you've seen some version of this prior, but then they flip it, invert some tropes, and undermine your expectations. And, you know, I was struck watching it again, having seen all 2 seasons of this show, that almost every character we meet at the beginning of this show, you get to know them as the show goes on. And that's the thing that keeps striking me about Sex Education is for a show that is on its surface, a super glossy, loving remix of 80s high school sex comedy movies, John Hughes movies and beyond. Like that's its touchstone. And it's like, so like you said, it's something you've seen before. You've seen this all before. The thing that blows me away about it is that from the very beginning is the empathy it has for the characters. Like every character has reasons for what they're doing and they have motivation. And when we meet Otis and Maeve and discover their background and we meet some of these other characters in those first few episodes, they come on at first as types. And then the more you learn about them, the more you learn, as you would in reality, that they're a real person who has a lot of backstory reasons why they are the way they are. They're not just a type out of, you know, a John Hughes movie from the 80s.
Yeah, definitely. And I think part of the reason I wanted everybody to watch the first 4 episodes is because it was just, you know, it's such a, I think the first 2 can lead you down a different path. Like your expectations after you watch the first 2 are in a different place than they'll be after you watch 3 and 4 and particularly 5. We just finished 5 in my class last night, as a matter of fact. And those are four and five are pretty big episodes. So is three. So it really kind of transitions into something different, mm-hmm. which is why I wanted people to at least get four in.
Yeah, well, the first two, it is setting up the premise, right? Like, yeah. The first, at the end of episode two, it's like, okay, Operation Sex Education is a go. We're going to do this. Otis is confident that he can help people. And Maeve is into, you know, they've got the business rolling. She can take the money. He's figured out he doesn't want to be like a priest because that's too weird, and he just wants to have a conversation at the house party, which is a very, again, very movie, teen comedy movie trope mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yep.
And then like Jackson's a great example, right? He is a golden boy. Maeve's would-be boyfriend and all of that, and he's got his swimming and all of those things, and he's got a history, and he's got a complication, and you know, Eric making it into the swing band, but there's a whole set of complications and things to navigate there. Like it goes like every character is allowed to have complexity to them.
Yeah, I think, and also it's the weird thing is, like, I really think if you were, not only did they just introduce the characters in the first two, but they also made it really entertaining. So it's, they're feeding you a number of characters, but they're also giving you like a modern teen comedy. Of course, it's British. So it's, you know, that the whole thing about taking sex head on is like so different. I've said this many, many times, and I say this to my students all the time. It's like in this country, because we're Puritans, founded on the Puritan way, we would rather see somebody have their face shot off than a little glimpse of their nipple. Whereas in England, they're like, okay, let's talk about sex and let's be like, let's find the comedy in it and let's find the sweetness in it at the same time. And so this show is unlike anything because it's so in your face. And then if it was just a traditional American show, it would never have been like that.
Yeah. And yet the show is so enamored with the American high school tropes,
yeah.
like to the point
yeah.
where the one that I noticed in the second watch is like, they got the Letterman jackets and they got the lockers and they got all yeah. these things that are not British school things. It is British in many ways, but they want it to feel like one of those American high school movies. And the one that makes me laugh is you don't see them playing soccer. You see them throwing around it's a rugby ball, but it's football shaped. And like that's one of those choices of like they just kind of want it to scan as American, even though it's
yeah.
not. It's shot in Wales, it's all British mm-hmm. actors, but it you want it to scan that way, and it's the bright colors and the, like I said, the lockers and the Letterman jackets and all of that kind of stuff. It is in its own little world, so it feels American and not, which I think as an American I think totally works because it seems kind of otherworldly. It's not quite right, and that's I would imagine if you're a British person it's a similar kind of feeling where it's like, well, this is not like, what is this? Where is this place?
This feels kind of similar, but not.
Yeah,
they definitely succeeded, I think. And I'm sure they wanted you to have a familiarity in the genre, and then to upend it. I mean, it starts almost immediately. It's like, you know, from Otis having his like sexual issues and his mom being very out because she's a sex therapist. You know, and things even like when Maeve and Jackson have sex, it's not Jackson who's like the typical American teen boy who would be like, yeah, that didn't mean anything to me, I'm gone. She's just like, whatever, dude, I just had sex with you. I don't need your address. You know, it's like she yeah. is much more progressive. They take that to the third episode is something they would like. I don't think I've ever seen in an American show where they literally get right into. Not only do they tackle abortion right away. They, you know, I, as I put it to my students, like, if this is an American show, they would have spent so much time on this decision and all these ramifications and not done it nearly as nuanced as this show. And to me, the funny part of Sex Education is it definitely tracks in different ways. It tracks on the drama, and the drama starts to build in mm-hmm. particularly in episode three onward. But it never lets go of the humor. And I love the fact that when Otis goes, thinks he's going to go on a date to a sushi place and ends up going, and it's going to be the Maeve in the abortion clinic helping Maeve, which is a sweet gesture. The fact that he runs into anti-abortion protesters,
yes.
You know, if this was the U.S., if this was a U.S., strictly a U.S. show, that would have been so ugly, that scene. It would have just been very much political, and they would try to mine something out of that or make a larger point or actually make a very obvious point, one or the other. And in this one, they do the opposite, which is Otis kind of meets these two people and like enters their little world, and we find out more about them in hilarious and touching and funny ways.
Yeah.
And they make those characters real. And as I said to my students, that just like wouldn't really happen. I mean, a lot of American shows are getting better at that. But as far as the treatment of sex and taboo subjects, well, American taboo subjects, they wouldn't do that.
I think what's so remarkable about the abortion clinic scene as well is not only is it sweet because, you know, you one of the tricks here is you don't want it to make them seem mercenary about like, we're really glad all the kids at the school have sexual problems so that we can make money, right? Like,
right.
That's not. So here is an immediate thing, which is Maeve has to go have an abortion and Otis comes with her. And there is this whole like tension there. You got your romantic tension between them that is building. But he, you know, it's more than just that they're business partners and he is going to go and support her. And then with the protesters, you're absolutely right. Like, that is one of the more remarkable things is it's funny because, yeah. Of course, there are protesters and they're not the most organized protesters. But of course, if you go to an abortion clinic, there's probably going to be somewhere they're protesting. But the fact that even they are people and Otis talks to them and you get the sense that they are also, they're not a cardboard cutout. They are people who have their own issues and deserve some level of empathy and understanding, at least, you know, again, on a certain level. And mm-hmm. This show just will not stop saying everybody here is a person who has their own hangups just like you do. And it's remarkable. In season two, I mean, it's not a spoiler because I'm not going to tell you who it is, but in season two, there's an extended set of scenes involving somebody taking a morning after pill. Mm-hmm. And it's not quite as charged as going to an abortion clinic, but I was impressed then that it was also handled as empathetically and as tenderly and also humorously, but all at the same time. It was very much like the a different version of the abortion clinic scenes where this is an outcome of sex that happens. There are two people involved. There the male is supportive of the female when they go to handle it later. They both are, you know, in this position because of things about their lives. Like, I'm it's breathtaking to me. And I know it shouldn't be, but like, so many TV shows get by on shortcuts to characters and shortcuts to situations. And Sex Education just refuses, I think, to do that.
Yeah, the thing I said about the first season, so I hope people will keep watching if they did this little experiment with us, is that it just gets better every episode. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like, the fifth episode is such a major accomplishment. I mean, they're all really good, but that one is just such a major accomplishment. And, you know, you've already kind of seen by the third episode that it's not the show you thought it was in the first two. And I love that the whole thing has been set up that way. You know, not only were they character building, but they were just setting you up for, you know, this unexpected, and it humanizes everybody, as you said. So it's just a show that continues to surprise all the way through, which is really the hallmark of a great series, especially if you can be surprised today in 2020, that's an achievement.
And shout out to Lori Nunn, who is the creator of this show. She had basically no credits
mm-hmm.
before making this show.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a couple of like story credits for movies and short film. They're all short films. And then Sex Education, which she created and wrote more than half the episodes across the first two seasons. And, you know, big thumbs up to her because it's amazing.
Yeah. Excellent job.
Yeah. And the second season, I enjoyed it too. Like, I think there's a real question of how do you pick up the pieces and tell that story again? And I think they did a good job, and I think it picks up, it builds momentum as it goes. I think if you watch them all, you will feel a drop off between episode 8 of season 1 and episode 1 of season 2, and that's because they need to start low again and build you back up to reach the end. But everybody's got a backstory. Everybody has a reason for what they do. It's great.
Love it.
Great. One of the best. We should give our homework. Should we give our homework for next time?
Yes, and hopefully we'll get some feedback from this, other people who did watch these shows along with us.
Yeah, send in your thoughts about, you can do it about sex education. You can also do it about our next assignment for next time.
Which is I think in these times, we all need a comedy, which would be really good. So full season available on Hulu, and it is What We Do in the Shadows.
It goes down easy. I'll tell you, you start watching them, you're not going to want to stop.
Yeah, they're like 22 minutes that you power through them.
Yep, 10 episodes.
It's really fun and also unexpected. And also, can I say this with the utmost glee, it is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It is just ridiculous. And I just love that.
So what should the students be looking out for when they are screening What We Do in the Shadows? Any things to watch for, tips about what we're looking for here?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things you can look at. I think that, well, first of all, it's just so good. It's a crazy premise. Oh, by the way, the original movie that it's based on, I think, is also available on Hulu if you want to watch that first. The idea that they knew that there was more to that movie and then they could make it a weekly thing. I think the intelligence, because humor is obviously subjective, but when you're really laughing about something and something's really clever, I always love the fact that, like, man, this is so smart, even when it's being completely ridiculous. Like the fact that these vampires end up going to a city council meeting, mm-hmm. and like, what's that? I think that's the second episode.
Yep.
It's just, they handled that so well and hilarious, and also just like, you know, creativity in how they each one has their own character, the characteristics, just a very well thought out, and not like a, you don't really know anybody in the cast, but as you get going, you're like, oh, this was beautifully cast. I think you can see it when these people start to pop.
Yeah, and so this is based on the movie, and so involved heavily in the show are Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clement, because it was a New Zealand film, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is an American TV production. And then Paul Sims, who among other things did News Radio, is one of the producers of the show and wrote that city council episode. So
yeah, oh my God, it's just so good.
Yep. Yeah, and Paul Sims is involved in, I want to say Atlanta too. So it's
he's all over the map.
Pretty good stuff. Pretty good stuff. Yeah. Okay, What We Do in the Shadows. You're gonna like it.
It's also a great break because things are getting tense out there, man.
Yeah,
there's a virus. There's an election. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of madness.
Okay,
so
shall we do some real quick letters?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, we need more letters, but here's what I got. Lynn in Atlanta said, I started my homework assignment by watching the first episode of Sex Education. Really funny and a great cast, and love the music. I will agree. We talk about high fidelity, like 80s teen sex comedies. Like in the 80s, everything had a montage. There's lots of music being used in the background, and I think Sex Education nails that too. It mm-hmm. feels like an 80s teen sex comedy right down to the soundtrack.
Yep.
Matthew wrote in to say, just in case there's another episode of TVTM, thanks for the confidence, Matthew. Thanks.
Yeah, wow.
A lot of video game properties are being turned into TV shows like The Witcher, and movies like Mario Brothers. Don't even, Matthew, how dare you? I've seen that movie. It was really, really bad. Are there any that you are excited or pessimistic about? This is Matthew from the 702. Video games, is there anything that can transfer there?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a very minor video game player. My son was into it for a long time and it's less into it now. So I'm not the best at that. Although, cause I, you know, this whole thing about Hollywood and IP, it drives me crazy that they'll find it anywhere. I think there's so many good stories you could just create on your own. You don't need a video game backstory to do it. But on the other hand, if you're into, I would always think there needed to be some kind of immersive quality to it. That's why you play video games in the first place. Otherwise, you're just like watching someone else play.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge, right? Is what works for a video game story doesn't necessarily work for a regular story. And so, and most video game TV shows or movies end up being intellectual property licensing exercises.
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't mean they can't be good. They can be. But I think it's a lot harder when you're starting from a licensing of intellectual property. Oh, by the way, I watched the Raven's Banquet first episode. That's the Charlie Day Apple TV show about the video game company. And I thought it was funny, as well as being kind of pointed about the tech industry. I haven't gone back to it. I've heard that it actually picks up steam with later episodes, but I thought it was pretty funny. I thought it was pretty well done in its depiction. That one, more than Avenue 5, felt like a real successor to a Veep kind of show, which is your kind of scabrous look at an organization that's kind of messed up, and there are people there who are really talented who are trying hard, and there are other people there who are in positions of power who are really weird and hard to deal with. Like, I felt like that was a better fit. I thought that was a more successful show in the one that I've seen than Avenue 5 was, at trying that same kind of comedy thing as a Silicon Valley or a Veep. It felt more Veep than Silicon Valley to me, honestly. But
oh, that's good. I'm friends with Rob, so I have to watch that. Hopefully he's not listening so that he wouldn't know I'm watching it.
Is Rob McElhenney the one who's in it, or is Charlie Day the one who's in it?
Rob is the star.
Charlie is a producer and
executive producer,
writing credits. But okay, well, he's very funny. He is also, that is the awful character, right? That is the the lead character, but he's the one at the center who everyone else has to deal with because he's a maniac.
Yeah,
I enjoyed that aspect of it. I think I am attracted to stories about responsible people who have to deal with the irresponsible people who hold all the control over their lives.
I wonder why that is. Yes, but okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Deep breath.
Jason and Tim, this is from Frank. Have you ever considered a podcast on all things streaming, music, podcasts, film, and TV, the Streaming Talk Machine?
Oh.
There's a lot of things streaming, Frank. That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. I think the thing that we ran into was you have a full-time job doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
And now I have a full-time job that I can't talk about.
plus all your side projects.
Plus all my side projects. So it makes it a little harder.
Yeah.
We'll talk about
some of that here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we'll do that. I think that stuff will interest me, and because a lot of it relates to kind of what I'm doing now in some capacity.
I could drop in a little news here. They've officially named the new head of Hulu, but it's basically a Disney executive reporting to Disney, but there is a new head of Hulu. And also Bob Iger is leaving Disney, and they have a new CEO of Disney who came from the park side. But Iger, the part that I'm interested in is Bob Iger announced that he wants to be involved in his last, nearly 2 years before he retires, in getting the creative side of Disney working better, which I wonder what that means. But I think that's really interesting. Like, maybe he's talking about dealing with some of the challenges in integrating all the different groups that came over in the Fox acquisition. But Disney has been one of the top stories for us on this podcast and other podcasts like this over the last couple of years, and I that's going to continue. Like, there's a lot more I think that we're going to see from Disney in the next couple of years.
Oh, definitely. I think they're definitely making moves. Mm. Definitely to be continued, so and we'll, watch on them.
When things are more tangible, we'll talk about that a little more. And I'll throw out a plug here. My tech podcast, Upgrade, we do a segment every week called Upstream that is all about sort of streaming media stuff. And it used to be like this 1-2 punch where we'd talk about it on Friday, and then I'd talk about it with Mike Hurley on Monday, and we'd have different angles of it. TV Talk Machine, shifting gears a little bit, but Upgrade is still there. So if you don't like the tech stuff, maybe you could just listen to the Upstream part of that. And we'll
definitely see.
I have no current plans to launch a brand new podcast that is just focused on what's going on in these times of confusion in the streaming world. But there's a lot. This is Greg in the 202. He says, Tim and Jason, on February 21st, the Wall Street Journal reported that Fox is in talks to acquire Tubi, an independently owned ad-supported streaming service, and Comcast is in talks to acquire Vudu, an ad-supported streaming service owned by Walmart. I kind of get Fox's interest, seeing as how they emptied the closet in the deal with Disney. And they're probably prowling yard sales for a sweet used couch and a cardigan without too many holes. That's good knowledge, Greg. But what's up with Comcast? They're on the verge of launching the Peacock. What do they want with Vudu? The story indicates Comcast wants to merge Vudu with their Fandango Now streaming service, which I didn't even know was a thing until I read that. How many streaming services do they need redundantly? Yours, Greg in the 202. P.S. Thanks for hanging around.
Oh, that's nice. Thanks. That's what we're doing. We're hanging around.
Yeah.
I don't know. That is a great question. I think maybe it's one of those things where it's like everybody was like, yeah, we just need MySpace. Just buy it. I don't know what it is. Just buy it.
Buy it and sort it out later is what I was going to say. Like, yeah. I think Comcast is like, because Vudu's got like movie rentals and other stuff like that, that are an interesting part of the business that Apple also is a part of and Amazon is a part of. And maybe they're like, okay, well, we can do that. And maybe they think there's some scale there with their on-demand stuff. But I do think on one level, it's sort of like, this is maybe a distressed asset or a seller like Walmart that doesn't want to be in this business anymore, and Comcast is in that business, so they see an opportunity there. But I do think an aspect of it is really just, let's buy it and figure it out later. We could place more bets on this stuff because,
yeah,
you know, they're Comcast. All the bets are going to be in this area, and taking Vudu, and which I remember Vudu was originally like almost like a TiVo competitor, and that has been recast like a half a dozen times. So I'm sure they could do it again. Maybe they just want the name. It's better than Fandango now.
Definitely. Vudu is better. Just take the name. Also, it could be a catch and kill here. That's what's possible.
Yeah, it could be. And it could also be that this is all going to get rolled into something that is because they're Comcast, like, it's not just the Peacock, right? It's not just Peacock streaming. It's also Comcast having, as they lose cable customers or at least TV customers, if they can provide a la carte rentals and purchases of movies and TV shows to their internet customers, like they're in a lot of different businesses. We think of it as the entertainment business, but like being a cable company puts them in an interesting place that is not the same as just if they were a TV network.
Again, who knows what they're gonna do? They're just a big corporation with a lot of money.
Yeah, that's true. One last letter. This is Art from the 425. Art says, yoga lessons, wine tastings, vacations, side projects. I think we all know what's going on here. Tim has won a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award and is too humble to tell us. Well, pitter-patter, Goodman. Just show us your giant 6-foot cardboard check and get it over with. Art from the 425.
Way to go, Art. Wow. That was an unexpected treat to hear. Yes, I have won.
You're a genius. You're a MacArthur Genius Grant.
Yeah.
The genius of television criticism.
Yes. I think everybody who knows me is like the best.
And that's the point of those grants, by the way, is to allow the people doing excellent work, the most excellent work in the world, to quit their jobs and stop doing that work. That's why those exist, right?
Right. It's like, and it's another catch
stop,
and kill.
That thing we love? Stop doing that.
That thing that you're really good at? No, here's a bunch of money just to stop.
Just drink wine and go to Big Sur and hang out and get some tattoos and you're done. You're done.
Although I do
the world doesn't need your excellence anymore, sir.
I do love the emphasis he puts on, like, clearly that I'm, by all outward appearances, not really doing anything, which is very funny to me.
Yeah.
I love that. Which is actually not actually too far off the mark, but yeah.
It's all you're getting back into. Also, the good Letterkenny reference there, pitter patter.
Yes,
let's get at her.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Oh my god.
Oh, okay. I think we've reached the end of this episode, but we'll be back in an undetermined amount of time. That might be roughly 2 weeks from now, but who knows? Because it's Wednesday, and we've wrapped around almost all the way back to Thursday, which means we not technically missed a week, but almost very close.
It's,
so
it's very close. But you know what? We were we got it done,
we did.
Yeah, we're in this. We'll do this. If people want to come with us, we'll do this.
We're in it to win it, or something.
I love the person's like, you just gotta get another TV critic.
yeah.
Way to throw me under the bus, buddy.
No, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, I do know one other TV critic, but like again, that was not the point. The point was we're talking to Tim. It doesn't make the sense.
Man. See, you've barely gone and they already forgot you.
And they've already, that's right. Well, that's what happens when you win the genius grant. All right.
Yes, I love it.
Send us your tweets at TVTM or your emails at podcast@tvtalkmachine.com and we would love to hear them. And we will read them on the next episode because, we're still doing this.
Yes. Woo!
And until that time, What We Do in the Shadows, go watch it. That's your assignment. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.